Will you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? Serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker. We have Dan from San Clemente.
Oh, boy. Well, I want to thank you for letting me come here and talk to you tonight. I want to thank the birthday people for telling my story. Should only take me a couple of minutes and we'll wrap this up, since you've already heard my story. My name's Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And October 4th of 1988, I was scared straight. Scared straight in 88. Sober in October. And it's a really lousy time to get sober, actually, because now you have to go through Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and my birthday and the 4th of July and then your birthday and your girlfriend's birthday and graduation day. And so, yeah, it's just, I guess any day is a good day to get sober, right? I'm going to try and follow the format of professional AA poster boy speaking and try to tell the truth, which is very difficult for me because I am typically not good enough, and my story is never interesting enough. I always need to embellish it a little, to polish it up a little, so it's really interesting. And I've been an alcoholic since I was born, I think. I see videos where we used to have a brownie projector that my parents would video. That's what they called it then. Videoing was with a brownie projector, and they came in these little reels. It had these antlers with lights on it, so everybody would go like that, you know, when the lights came. Not me. I saw a film of this, me eating marshmallows as a little kid, like a one-year-old. And they came over and they handed me this little marshmallow, and I popped it in my mouth and ate it. And they walked back by with the bag of marshmallows, and I snatched it out of their hand and started going after it. And I thought, boy, it started early, didn't it? My story is, I never have been to jail yet. I don't have any real horror stories. When I drank, I had a good time. You know, I was the happy guy, you know. I guess my problem is when I drink, I buy you drinks and everybody else drinks, and then I don't have any money, and I get really frustrated by that. And I've always been told it's really good to be generous, and it's more blessed to give than to receive. And the problem is I've gone through about two or three inheritances, and they were pretty significant. And I've given them all away. So on the last one, I decided that I probably needed to stop doing that. And my mom died when I was about 12 years old, and they patted me on the head and they said, "Don't cry, Danny, and everything will be okay." So I didn't. And a lot of years went by, and I never shed a tear over anything. Dogs dying, you know, friends dying, whatever horrible divorces, girlfriends breaking up with me. I was just sort of a really hard-edged person and pretty angry, actually. Felt that I always got cheated. You know, she died on Halloween. And so, you know, the ghosts and the goblins and the bones and the death and all that stuff, I never was real comfortable with Halloween, so I'd pump it up pretty good at that one. And I didn't like Mother's Days either. They weren't happy times for me. And so I had a pretty good resentment, and I thought I had a damn good resentment to be mad at everybody, and you know, especially when you had a mom, and you know, and I didn't. And so about 2 years after my mom died, my dad decides to move us from downtown Des Moines to this town called Ankeny, Iowa, which I refer to as Agony, Iowa. And because it went from bad to worse, I grew up in Minnesota on a beautiful lake, and then we had this promotion where we moved to Iowa. And it was just really, really difficult for me to get comfortable for some reason. I just didn't like it there. But I went back recently for a reunion, high school reunion, and I can appreciate all the wonderful, magical things about Iowa now, like cornfields that are, and the peace and fresh air and silence and tranquility and serenity and dirt roads that go on endlessly, and I can appreciate that now. It's almost like I can sit on the beach and look at the water and go off endlessly. I can do the same thing, and I've come to learn that from Alcoholics Anonymous. I can appreciate, you know, I can appreciate everything, anything that's happening to me, because there's a power greater than myself that's running the show, not me. And I turn my will and my life over to that higher power. You know, sometimes he does a really, really great job, and sometimes we disagree on what should be going on. So I went to high school in Ankeny, and on my gravestone it'll say I'd rather be here than in Ankeny. But I said, you know, I have one life to live, and this is not a dress rehearsal, so every minute of every day I'm going to party my off. I am going to party so hard, because at 15 my dad married one of his secretary, and we moved out to Ankeny, and her two daughters were cheerleaders, and I never played sports or anything. I never felt like I needed to. I was kind of the hippie guy with the long hair and the patch jeans, and I played guitar, and I liked Neil Young and Bob Dylan and peace, and, you know, wore beads, and, you know, I didn't like war. I was all anti-war and everything. And my best friend was a Sioux Indian, and he had long black hair, like this long, and he was really handsome, and I was handsome, and chicks dug us, and God, high school was great, you know, but we never went to class. We just, you know, that was for the nerds. So at about 16, he had a really cool GMC van with Krager mags, and we did an airbrush of an Indian sitting on the back of a horse, and on the side and inside of it had like this flat steering wheel and this big powerful engine, and you know, we were just all stoned and driving around in this thing thinking, you know, I was the guy that could get stuff, you know. I got kegs, and back in Iowa they didn't have pictures on their driver's licenses back then. And so I was 16 and my brother was 18, so he mysteriously lost his driver's license one day and never found it again. So at that day I turned into Brad Tangerman. And so at 16 I was hanging out in bars. And I had my own apartment. I ran away from home. And I got my own job, my own car, and I you know, at 15, I hitchhiked. My dad went to Arizona, and I was working at a gas station on the freeway. And I'm the kind of guy that's I like adventure. So I went out on that freeway, and I was working at a gas station, and right on the I-35 freeway. And he had gone to Arizona with my stepmom, who hated me, and to go to visit my grandparents. So I had this great idea. I'd go down there and visit them while they were down there. So I walked out to the freeway and hitchhiked to Arizona. My dad was shocked, and my stepmother was shocked. Now being an adult, I can imagine what she must have been thinking. Oh, no, not him. He's like a bad dream coming around here. So what this has to do with being sober, I'm not quite sure yet. I'm still standing here in abject terror, trying not to lie. Told you the story was not real exciting, but so as a runaway, I decided at 16, I was almost 17. I was about a month short of 17, and the Vietnam War was kind of winding down, and I was really tired of agony, and I said, you know what, I'm going to join the Navy. So I went from the peace signs and no anti-war and all that stuff to being a somebody kicked my ass in high school or something, and it really made me mad. So I thought, well, I'll go join the Navy, and they'll make a man out of me. So my I grew up in the streets. That's where I learned to drink. And then my finishing school was the United States Navy, where they really polished my skills to power it down. And so I got into boot camp, and I did that whole deal. And then I said, well, I probably need to go special missions because those guys are, you know, really tough and stuff. And besides, I'm an enlisted man, and it was about the first day I was actually out in the fleet that I realized that being an enlisted man in the Navy was not the hot tip for an officer like me. And so I was having a real hard time taking direction, if you know what I mean. And the freedom thing wasn't working out too good either, because I had to go where they told me, when they told me, for however long they wanted me to be there. And I wanted to go where I wanted to go, when I wanted to go there, for however long I felt like being there. And that just, you know, we were butting heads. But I did it for 4 years. And then when I did the special missions thing, it gave me the opportunity to wear special clothes and people didn't screw with me too much. And then I went back to my high school reunion and people didn't screw with me too much anymore. And now I'm an old man and I'm fat and people could really screw with me again, which is sort of a disappointment. A full circle here. I thought after I got 24 years of sobriety, I'd have my shit together better, but I don't. It just seems to get worse. I just seem to know less and less and less. I thought, if you'd have known me the first year, you should have met me when I first got here. I had it all going on. In fact, my first 11 days in the rehab, I read the big book because I'm a voracious reader. And I read the 12 and 12 and the Came to Believe and Living Sober. And I was in the spin dry over here at South Coast Medical Center. And they just they said, okay, yeah, you know what? It's probably not a good idea for you to be wearing a suit around here in the hospital as a patient. And I had silk pajamas, and they wanted me to wear these things where you tie them in the back, and I wouldn't. I wanted to wear my silk pajamas. I bought it at Nordstrom, and I let everybody know that. And because I am a styling sort of guy, you know, and I want everybody to respect me and like me, and I'm not putting that outfit on and go through your detox because I really don't need a detox. I'm just a little depressed. And I mean, after all, I'd run the LA Marathon that year, and I had won the Los Angeles Airport Softball League Championship. My team had won it. No, I won it. I did it all. It was me. Let's be honest here, you know. If it wasn't for me, they wouldn't have anything. And neither would anybody. So, or at least that's the way it was. I guess maybe it's not quite so true now. So here I was, this scared little guy, you know, and when I say special missions, I'm going to backtrack on that because that conjures up U.S. Navy SEALs and all that kind of stuff. And I'm actually like this dope-smoking hippie that got in the back of a... I said, I want to go fixed-wing aircraft carrier. So, of course, they put me land-based helicopters, which is, you know, you get this dream sheet out of boot camp. And so they put me there. And then when I got there, I realized, well, geez, these guys riding around in the back of the helicopter, they're never here working, and I'm here working. I could be riding around in this helicopter smoking dope and drinking while we're flying. And because, you know, there's no war, so it's cool, right? It's all right. So there I was, and now I have to make this decision. Do I want to actually go through all this work, learning how to scuba dive and, you know, climb in and out of rafts and parachuting and all this stuff that scares me because I don't like anything that's physical. And the only way to get this is to do that. So I did. And then I became that. And I did all kinds of crazy stuff. We used to fly medevac to Road Atlanta and Daytona and Sebring, and because there was really no war. We flew hurricane disaster relief. We flew shark watch, which was basically looking at the girls on the beach. you know, we used to fly this thing called carrier quals. We'd fly out to the aircraft carriers and land. And so it was really a great job. I loved the Navy and I had a great time. And But I was not a Navy SEAL. When I was in the bar drinking, I was. In fact, I was a doctor one time, and I actually played for the Miami Dolphins, too. But that's when I was in Australia or New Zealand. I can't remember which. I was really drunk at the time. God, I jump all over with this story. I'm so sorry, people. But it's my life. I have attention deficit disorder, and I can't even pay attention to myself, for Christ's sake. It's horrible. Back to me. I was thinking about you for a second there, but that's short-lived. I like to tell what it was like was I married a Pan Am stewardess, and I could drink for free in the front of the airplane. And that was great. And I did that a lot, and I did that all over the world. And then one day we woke up, and she went, "You know what? You suck. And I'm sick of your ass. I'm going to New York." And it was right before I was about 15 minutes before I was going on my third or fourth interview. I was doing TV commercials in Hawaii. And so I had to go and stand in front of this camera and all these people and agents and all this stuff. And they threw me a beach ball and said, "Jump up and down and act happy." And I was like 15 minutes before my wife told me, "You know what? We're done." So, of course, I didn't get it. I was close. And the smart thing was to follow her to New York and try and work it out, stalk her. And that didn't work out. So I went back to Iowa and I got a job at KJJY FM 106 for the best in country music. Keep it here. More music without all the talk. That was my job. Which was kind of a cool job because it was during the urban cowboy days, and so I couldn't buy a drink in these lounges, you know. It's the cowboy dance stuff, and me and John Travolta. And before that, I met my first wife in a disco in, I think, Florida somewhere. I was really the Johnny Travolta disco Danny, I think they called me. And I still like that music, though. I don't give a shit what you think about me. I just love disco music. It's great. So now she leaves. It hurts my feelings. The one chick in here I liked, you know. So anyway, don't anybody else get up. I'm really insecure. I'll go after you like a comic. What were we talking about? Oh, me. My favorite subject. So where did I go after the discos? Yeah, Iowa, but thank you. Of course, after I got that job and I was really happy, joyous and free and drinking all the time for free again, I found a new avenue to alcohol for free, and she shows up again. So she talks me into going to California, and that's how I ended up out here, and then she, of course, decided that it wasn't going to work out again. the whole drinking thing. Oh yeah, when that happened when we got divorced, we said goodbye in San Diego, and I got into my Chevy Chevette that was smacked over and the windshield was broken and kind of went down the road sideways and stuff. And that was not really my style of car. I like Maseratis and Lamborghinis and Porsches and stuff like that. And I've never had one, but I sure like them. So I ended up in, Rodeo Drive. What do you do when you got $135, your wife has just dumped you, and you have no home, and you have no place to live, and you're in San Diego driving north on the 5 freeway? Where do you go? I go to Hollywood, to Rodeo Drive, to the, what's that hotel? Thank you, the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and I rent a room. And they park my Chevy Chevette for me with this cracked windshield and the broken front end and the license plate that's falling off. And so I went up and I sat in a marble bathtub, and I thought the little alcohol things in the refrigerator were free because they were on the plane. That's what I was used to drinking, and so I nailed them all. And then I went back downstairs to check out the next morning, and I didn't have enough money for that. And then when the guy brought my car up, I didn't have enough money to pay him, and he was really nice and gave me money. And I said, "Dude, really? Yeah, aren't I smart?" So I drove down to Venice Beach, and I lived on Venice Beach for a couple of days. And I mean, on Venice Beach. So that's where alcohol sort of takes me. It's like a roller coaster of up and down, up and down. And I have this part of me that doesn't think I deserve anything. Don't know why, don't know where I came from. You know, maybe it was my father. You know, I love to blame other people for stuff, but when I do that, then I have no control over my own life if I'm continuously blaming others for what's happening to me. And they told me at Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, as long as you come here and you try to identify with, we're going to talk about recovery now. As long as, which, why we're here, I guess. I thought we were here for me. but if I'm blaming other people for what's happened to me, then I'm powerless to change it. I'm powerless to change that because those people are in control of me still. And it's the poison, resentment is the poison that I'm taking to kill my enemies. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we can't afford that. And when we get here, we feel better. I just wanted to feel better when I first got here. I just wanted to feel better. And I feel pain better. I feel anger better. I feel frustration better. I feel it all. And that's why I have to do these steps. I had to do this fourth step and figure out what my part in all this stuff was. And that's why I have to be rigorously honest, because left to my own devices, I'm a Navy SEAL. I'll kill myself or whatever. And, you know, I apologize to anybody I've ever lied to. I try to do that every time I speak in a meeting. I try to always tell the truth. And, that's the key. If I tell the truth, then the truth sets me free. I don't have to worry about what I said or try to remember that. I never lived anywhere longer than a couple of months while I was drinking. When I got sober, the way it shook out was I was at Santa Barbara going to college studying theater, directing. And I came down here for a wedding. My girlfriend's friend was getting married at this church. And I was raised as an Episcopalian. My mom took us to the Episcopal church every Sunday. After she died, we quit going. So I made a connection here, like a spiritual connection, an ancestral spiritual connection. It took me to a higher spiritual awareness. And I bought this Bible, and I took it with me. And I set it by my bedside at Santa Barbara, and there was a sort of a conflict there, you know, sleeping with 10 or 15 girls and, you know, partying my ass off all the time and having this Bible sitting by my bed and then reading Matthew and Daniel, because, of course, those are my names. And those are probably the most, if you look at a woman, pluck your eye out. It's like a log, you know. What? Really? Really? God, man, I'm a mess. And I that was kind of the... there was that conflict, and all of a sudden I said, God, help me. I looked in that mirror with my, I was standing with a rum and coke, and I had a cigarette, and one more time, you know, I was playing harmonica. I played blues harmonica, and I was playing it in this bar pretty regular, and so I was getting ready for my gig, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I go, man, you are not what your mom raised you to be. You are a piece of shit, and I'm sick of your ass. I looked great. I had nice clothes, beautiful apartment, nice car. I used to have a car with a phone in it in 88. People didn't have phones in their cars in 88. They had a little pigtail coming out of the trunk, this big old thing in the trunk, and a thing in the front with a handset and a cord. I'm driving around, I'm talking on that thing, and there's nobody even listening. But I wanted everybody to know I had it. And So then I come here, I've got this conflict going on. I said, God, help me. And the next thing I know, this guy is saying, I'm sitting in this restaurant eating a steak dinner, and I feel like shooting myself, but I don't have a gun. I really don't want to live anymore because of this conflict. I was raised one way, and I'm acting another way, and I've got this conflict going on, and I can't handle it. And I finally just said, something's got to change. I cannot do this anymore. And this guy, right when I said, God help me, this guy came walking up and he walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He got me into the spin dry over here at South Coast Medical Center. And I went through that in 11 days. I had become the president of the hospital and was running everything. And they kicked me out, said my insurance ran out. And then in fear, I stopped at the morning meeting up at St. Catherine's Church, and I met a gentleman there. I, for the first time in my life, I really got honest, and I said, you know what, I'm really scared about going back to L.A. I don't want to do this. I'm really terrified. And this guy said, you know what, I'll be your temporary sponsor. And I'm opening up this recovery home, and his name is Father Bob, and he happened to be an Episcopal priest. And he was my spiritual director for a long, 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 long time. And he was my sponsor for 21 or 22 years. Temporary sponsor. Because, you know, there's any time, I'm out of here. And that's why I just do this Alcoholics Anonymous thing still, well, 24 years at a time now. But, I mean, it's just, I literally for the first couple of years had my bag packed. And so I was living with Bob, and he helped me through the steps. And then I met my wife, actually, at a meeting over here at the Capitol by the Sea. It was a rehab up on the hill, and that's where she had gone through, and she has more time than me. And we got married in this church right over there. Our wedding cake was right over there. And that was the kitchen at the time, and that opened up, and I had probably 250 drunks in here. We're still married. And I'm still living in San Clemente in the same neighborhood. Because I don't lie, cheat, steal. You guys have taught me how to live a happy, sober, and right life. And I wouldn't trade the last 24 years of my life in for any. And I had a good time out there because I was handsome. I was smart. I was witty. I was quick. I was clever. I never got busted. I always just got away with it. And chicks dug me. And I could just lie to my heart's content. And everybody believed me because I was handsome. And now I'm fat and old and ugly, and chicks still dig me because sometimes I cry in meetings and I show my emotions. And I have what a dope. God. So you know, I always wanted to be the tattoo guy, the Harley guy. I wanted to be the airline pilot, the astronaut, the doctor. I want to be everybody. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that I can be just me. And what's cool about this program, if you're new here, is it really doesn't matter. You know, whereas I kind of had a mindset where I wanted everybody to be like me, you know. I wanted to be like them and them to be like me, and then we'd all fit in, and wouldn't that be cool? Because we're all cool, right? But Alcoholics Anonymous, we love each other here no matter what. You know, if you got millions of dollars, we'll live with you. If you got no money, we'll love you just as much. And if you're really sick with this disease, we'll love you until you can love yourself. And if you're well and you're healed and you're all better, we'll still let you come here. Because we all have this disease that tells us that we're all okay. You know, that we really don't have a disease and we don't really need to be here. And it's a cunning, baffling, and powerful, tricky disease. And it gets me all the time. If I don't come to meetings and I don't help you and I don't talk to my sponsor and I don't read the big book and I don't work those steps on a regular basis. I said that word work, didn't I? It doesn't say that in the book. It says these are the steps we took. And the word work kind of is anti-Dan. So those are the steps I take one day at a time. I got here, and I, honest to God, I just never, ever thought that I would be here this long. I was looking at maybe a year. Because when I first got here, I was looking at maybe a month. And then I met my wife, and she became my higher power until I could find God. And now, you know, we've got a really healthy relationship. We go to AA, Al-Anon conventions, and not so much right now because we have kids, but we used to go to all the AA conventions and Camp Sealy, and that'd be the AA Al-Anon meetings. And we threw ourselves into this thing 100%, you know. And if you're new here and you throw yourself into it 100%, it's a really great deal. And you know, I love my wife. Chicks dig me when I do this. And I love my daughters, and they know it because I tell them and I show them. And I grew up in a family where we didn't do that. We're Minnesotans, you know, we're men. And you know, I'm the California granola eating. I think they think I'm gay, except I'm married. So I'm always hugging on my brothers, you know. And there's a big family, so there's a lot of them to get after. Anyway, I don't know when I'm supposed to stop. Somebody tell me stop, like this. But I have never done a 40-minute pitch, man. I've done like birthday things that I went over time. I typically share. I never go over 3 to 5 minutes. Well, that's not true. Maybe if I got really good sharing, I'm really on a roll, I'll go 6 or 7 minutes. But this is really fun. I feel for you guys, and there's a lot of hostage crises out there that I can see. You know, they're like, oh my God, how long is this guy going to drone on? And I got to tell you, I love standing up here. I'll never do it again. So buy the tape, because you're never going to hear this shit again. And I didn't mean to swear. I learned that word here. In Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's one thing that in closing I want to tell you. If you don't have a higher power, good luck. Because man, this disease is just unbelievable, and it will come from all different angles. And I've seen it, and I've been around here quite a while now, and I've seen better men than I drop, taken out at the knees by this disease. People working a better program than me, taken out at the knees. I've seen people that I had so much admiration for come back as newcomers, and it shocked me. And I'll also tell you that I've seen people leave and then they live happy, joyous, and free lives. So they say. So my hat's off to them. And you may be one of those people. You may be here on a court card, and yeah, the judge is a jerk, and you know nobody here likes you, and you know all that stuff that we say to ourselves when we come here on court cards. But I will tell you that if you have a court card, my number is 949-280-6768. And I wasn't brought here on a court card, but my roommate at the time I got sober was telling me all about how his experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was trying to pitch the program to him. I was trying to sell it to him. I was trying to get him on board. And I wanted him to have what I had, that 30 days sober. And he didn't want it. The headlock and the punching didn't help. But you know, Frank never got this thing, you know, to my knowledge. You know, I don't know why we're sober today, those of us that really are here sober, but it's a gift. It's a gift, man. And I don't ever want to look this gift horse in the mouth. I don't ever want to take it for granted. I don't ever want to rest on my laurels like they talk about. Every day that I wake up, you know, maybe if I don't believe in a higher power, maybe I should get on my knees and take that physical action to make that connection. Because I'm not doing it for God, I'm doing it for me when I get on my knees. Because maybe I don't believe in God today. You know, and I got a higher power that believes in me no matter what. And just because I don't believe in Him doesn't mean He doesn't exist, because I'm not that big a deal. In fact, I got a power greater than myself that loves me no matter what. And that cat can fix anything, financial, whatever. In fact, if I get pissed off at my wife or whatever, I go out to the car and go, hey, you married us, fix it. And I can't fix it. Fix me. And then, you know, then something happens that really humbles me or something and embarrasses me or whatever. And, you know, He's in charge, man. It's a cool thing, because I don't have to be the general manager of the universe anymore. I can just kind of go along for the ride, and most of the time I do that. And most of the time, it's pretty easy going. This is the easier, softer way. Because, okay, girls, you can jump for joy, because here comes the cat daddy, and he's the good time boy. That's my mantra, you know. I don't like work. I'm a lazy guy. I like having fun. If this wasn't fun, I would not be here. But there's a couple tricks to this. There's a couple of things, a couple of rules, that some things and disciplines that I needed to change and make in my life. And is that, you know, I go to meetings pretty regularly. I read the big book regularly. I call my sponsor regularly. I reach out in the meetings regularly, and I try to be of love and service. I try to clean up after meetings and not tell anybody. I try to be of love and service and not get caught. I try to do nice things for people all through my life, and sometimes, you know, you think you're not getting caught, but your higher power is watching and he digs it. And I'm gonna close by saying this, that I think gratitude is probably the most important attitude that I can adopt, being grateful. Because as an alcoholic, I only want one thing, more. I just want more, whatever it is, I just want more. And as an alcoholic, I have to be satisfied with what I have and be content. And this disease tries to take my gratitude away. So if I can be smart enough, I can realize when it's happening. When I'm not happy, it's my fault. It's something I'm not doing. And I got to go back. If I want to drink, which, by the way, hasn't happened to me since I got sober, until about 3-4 weeks ago when my dog died, it hurt so bad that I wanted to drink. And that's the only time that I can remember that it popped into my head. Like, you know what, I'll show these people that I'll hurt me, you know, if they don't care about my dog, you know. But when it was your dog 6 or 7 months ago, I was like, yeah, bummer. You know, because it's happening to you, it's not a big deal. When my dad dies, it's a big deal. When your dad dies, it's, you know, it's part of life, you know, keep coming back. And F you, I don't want to come back. I'm pissed off. So anyway, I think my time is up, thank God. And thank God for you guys sitting here listening. I really had fun. Yeah, right. Again, the number is 280-949-280-6768. Buy the tape. I'll be here all week. Thanks for letting me share.